You're listening to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. This episode is a live session from day 5 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023, and it's called Empire, the story of a world-conquering podcast. William Dalrymple and Anita Anand in conversation with B. Rowlett. There
Good morning, JLF. How are you today?
Yes!
Welcome to Empire, the podcast that conquered the world. See what they did there?
Out of the cage, she springs.
Oh, God, he's interrupting me already.
I know. Shush.
And so is she. Have you got any idea what a challenge this is to try and rein these two in? So prepare to have your ears and your hearts colonized by these conquerors. Anita Anand and... William Dalrymple. Friends of the podcast will know what just happened there.
Yeah.
It's just a baby podcast. It's only 5 months old.
Barely.
I want to go back to its conception, if that's not too creepy, of your joint baby. Anita, tell us how it came about.
Well, so we worked on a book together, which is also an accidental book that happened, which is the Kohinoor Diamond. So Willie had...
Born at the Jaipur Literature Festival.
It was born here. Yes, and gosh, you're the mummy and daddy of our careers together, actually. So we were in the green room, and we both come to talk about our own respective books. Return of the King, and I was talking about Sophia, and glinting in the backgrounds of both of these books that we'd done was this little Kohinoor Diamond story. And so I know he'll try and take credit, but I said, why don't we do a book about this? But then I promptly forgot I'd said it and did nothing about it. And he rang up 2 months later and said, why don't we work together? I've got a publisher. And I was astonished, and we did. And it was such a fruitful relationship. And the thing about working together is that he makes me laugh a lot.
There was one incredibly embarrassing moment on the book tour when we were all staying at the same hotel in Mumbai on the way to the Mumbai Literary Festival.
Yeah.
And I was with Anita, Olive was there, and Bridge Keenan
there.
And you know those five-star hotel breakfast rooms in the morning, completely silent, with the noise of coffee cups on saucers and the rip of croissant in the background, or the frizzle of dosa in this case. Anita turns up, and within 2 minutes, Olive and I are both rolling around on the ground, laughing and making a complete scene in this previously quiet and peaceful breakfast room.
Basically, we can never go back there. That's the main headline of the story. But we had a good friendship, and it's a friendship based on a lot of laughter, but also a lot of respect, because you know we
shared interests.
Interested in the same things, but also love learning from each other. So the Empire
that could have led to another book, but it led instead to
Empire. So my career is in radio. I work for radio and TV, and I present. But then you were a guest on another very famous podcast, weren't you? That's what happened.
So one of the more sort of unlikely developments in the last year, really, in Britain, has been the fact that in a podcast chart usually dominated by sort of podcasts called "I Shagged My Boss" or. Or something, you know. That
or I murdered
sort of
my boss.
I always wondered how you got a job on this festival, Willie.
It's sex and murder does very
sex
well.
Sex and murder,
yeah.
This sort of thing.
Yeah.
Three podcasts have risen to the top, and they've all been from the same stable. And that stable, rather surprisingly, is founded and owned by the Britain's top footballer, Gary Lineker, who has, on top of his career in football, a remarkable broadcasting career. And he kicked off, first of all, I think, with Tom Holland's brother, James, who did a podcast on the Second World War. Then, crucially, Tom Holland came in with Dominic Sambrook to found The Rest is History, that is now literally the top podcast in almost every English-speaking country in the world. And I went on that podcast, and partly because, as you know, anything in India just involves vast figures. And Indian authors sell more books. Indian people that write about India have larger Twitter followings. For that reason, both podcasts I went on to an empire were, at the time, much their highest downloaded things.
No, it's because you are good, actually. And also, he was out of control, let me tell you. So they found it very difficult to discipline William, who quite possibly turned the half-hour podcast into a three-hour podcast. But it had such a huge response of love and affection. Well, I don't know. You guys aren't familiar with Fenton the dog. How can you explain Fenton the dog? There was a little viral video that went around of a poor man trying to control his dog in Richmond Park, which just didn't listen to him. It was running, running, and all you hear is this poor man going, Fenton, Fenton! And that's what they did on the podcast.
Whole herd of deer being chased by this dog in the distance.
How does this lead to your podcast? So you
would hear
on...
When I careered off on my own telling this story, Tom Holland was saying, this is just like Fenton the dog. Yeah. He won't obey any command.
So then the company came to you and they said, look, would you like to do a podcast because you're good? And would you like to do it with somebody?
And 2 days before, I'd had dinner with Anita in her very nice pub in her street.
Yeah.
And I'd spent the whole of the drive back thinking through things she said and laughing at all the jokes that I'd missed, the punchlines that I hadn't got at the time.
Very sweet.
And I remember thinking, if I ever was to be asked to do a podcast, I know exactly who I'd be doing it with. So this request came 2 days later. And I suggested her name instantly that I was asked. And it turned out that the producer, Jack Davenport, had worked with her in Radio 5, and Anita was his favourite broadcaster in the world.
That's very sweet.
And she is astonishingly good and quick and brilliant.
All right. Let's stop the love. I want to get to awkward places. And I know that the producer, Callum, is right here.
Long-suffering. He's
so
a husk of a man.
So I'm going to ask you questions, and then I'm going to look at Callum to see whether he's going, no, that's not true. I want to know about the editorial process. So you started on home turf, subjects that you've both written loads of books around. So it started in the familiar. And in season two, you've moved elsewhere.
We
don't have a huge amount of time. Talk us through the editorial process, the decisions in where you're going to go, what happens with the research, etc.
Just so quickly, the first thing we tried to do, of course, was Koh-i-Noor, because we'd done it before. Yeah. And it was meant to be a one-part podcast. But because the two of us just can't shut up, it ended on going on for four hours. And we ended up splitting it into four episodes.
But the point is, we don't have 4 hours now. No. So
to answer your actual question, is we decided that the territory that we were both passionate about, and also that there seemed to be a hunger for in Great Britain, because there's this thing, I'm sure you may have heard of it, called the culture wars, where it's become quite difficult and contentious to discuss stuff that happened. It was the Indian side which we started with, and we decided to go right back to the beginning. So in a way, both of us sort of have a half and half speciality. The early part of the British's arrival, and mine is the latter part. So right from the East India Company, we thought, wouldn't it be great if we actually had, rather than just separate different subjects, took you on a trip right from the very moment the British twinkled here all the way to when they left and partition happened. So that was quite ambitious, but that's what we did. And as far as sort of planning each episode, I mean, I'd like to say there's a lot of structure and thought that goes into it, but we have a chat.
And somehow it just goes awry.
We just sort of have a chat in the middle of the week that these are the things that we think are interesting, and we get through about half of those when we actually sit down to record. Nothing is scripted.
About fact-checking, research?
Oh, no, we do a lot of work. That we do a lot of work. We want to make sure that we're right.
So you do that beforehand?
Yeah. There's a lot of work. It's like doing, I've said to somebody, it's like doing a Viva every week. So you sort of feel like, I mean, and I'm thrilled because I was a swotty, geeky girl. So I get to be a swotty, geeky girl all the time. But you're doing a lot of work as well, which is, you know.
Unusual.
you said it, but it's a true story. You are knuckling down, and we're learning things that, you know, we're now out of our comfort zone because we're doing the Ottomans. And that's been a huge, very interesting thing.
Because you start off talking about stuff you obviously know very well. We're now in territory which is fascinating, but we know less well. And it obviously takes more work, and there's more margin of error if you get it wrong. But the key thing, in a sense, the logs to cling on to amid the wreckage is this extraordinary roster of historians who've come to the Jaipur Literature Festival. And over the 15 years of this festival and other festivals, you know, JLF now has branches in Adelaide, in Boulder, in New York, in Toronto. I've seen on stage most of the world's great historians. And not all the great historians, of course, or not all great writers can talk. But we now have a pretty good idea of those that can and those that can't. So we have a really good list of the great talkers out there who are also great scholars, and we've just rung them up.
Yeah.
And no one has yet. Has anyone said? No one said no.
No one said no. But you know, the doing the work is really very serious. It's taken over. Both of us are struggling to write books at the same time. And if my publishers are here, I'm very sorry. I am very late. But this has kind of taken on a life of its own. And every single, it is like the most fabulous relay race where two of you are running together, so it's not so lonely. You know you're not going to fall back and humiliate yourself, so you can sort of push each other along. But you just keep passing the baton. And, I like to think, actually, we're taking part in a very important conversation that needs to be had about the kind of the
and that's
the
important
theory.
I just want to put this in context. In the British context, the government just last week announced the appointment of an anti-woke czar, according to the Daily Mail, which is someone who presumably's job it is to stop people being mean about the British Empire. So I'm wondering if that's going to reverb back onto you.
So I think the background that will surprise...
It speaks to the climate of conflict and division that you mentioned earlier.
I don't think people in India have the slightest conception how little the British people know about their own empire. It's not on the curriculum, astonishingly. Anita said, quite rightly, at school she learnt about the Roman Empire.
The Tudors. I can tell you about an aqueduct. I could draw you a Tudor beam, but we really didn't do and something this, as recent as empire history.
And it's not just the elephant in the room, it's this enormous mammoth. And the British also peddled this line, which is reflected in the statements of government ministers and in the understanding, national understanding of itself, that Britain was the home of freedom, that it was a place that invented democracy, that brought liberation to the world. And so the version of history they get is that Britain liberated the slaves, but they're not talking about the slave trade. They would talk about how it saved the world from the Nazis and Napoleon, but we don't talk about our own empire. Mm. And so the people out there genuinely believe that this is a country which brought freedom and democracy and liberal values everywhere it went, rather than the much more bloody, complicated story of genocides, wiping out of entire peoples, the export of capitalism, industrializing the slave trade from something which had existed almost everywhere in the globe, but something which suddenly became much larger, much crueler.
I think you're definitely right with a certain generation, but I do think that it's an intergenerational thing, and that young people are much more aware.
Well,
and just as a really small example, I took my kids last month to see the Tollywood movie, are any South Indians in the house? Yes, Natu Natu, dance off later. And there's a scene where, it was a largely white young audience. Everybody watched, right, including a bunch of young white kids in a packed cinema in London, and they cheered and cheered. And the biggest cheer is when, the arch villain Scott Buxton's blood is splashed across a sign that says the sun never sets on the English Empire.
Right.
Everyone went nuts for it.
Well,
our podcast
is not as covered in mire and gore, but also I don't think it's as controversial. So in the background, you're absolutely right. There is this political wrestling match going on about what should and should not be said, and we actually just think it's a lot simpler than that. I wanted to subtitle our podcast "Stuff That Happened." It's just not this stuff happened. It is not up for political debate. This happened. This happened. This happened. This happened. You can argue about the rights and wrongs, but there are some incontrovertible facts, and we would like to give those to you. So we somehow, I think, bypass the culture war, or we haven't signed up for it. I want no part in it, but I do very much want to tell people, actually, this is stuff that happened, and then it's up to you to do what you want with
and
it.
And equally important, I think, is to slay myths when they are myths on the other side. For example, there's a widespread belief in this country, frequently figured in the language and the mythology of the freedom movement, that the British cut off the thumbs of the weavers of Bengal. You find it frequently referred to. Now, there's actually a very interesting story behind that that doesn't actually, it's no better, but it's not true in the form that it's told. The story about the thumbs originates in a book written by a man called William Bolts. William Bolts was an enemy of Robert Clive and got expelled from India and his business wrecked when Clive got rid of him and expelled him back to Britain. He took revenge by being the whistleblower, the first man to write about a book about what the East India Company had done. And it's full of very important stuff. But it is the work of a man who had an axe to grind and was going out to destroy someone. And it's not necessarily a book that can be taken at face value. You've got to read it carefully, and you've got to look for other sources to verify what he's
saying. I think it's an excellent example there that we're trying to slay dragons on both sides, that wherever there is nonsense, we try and deal with that.
What he says, and this is where the story of the thumbs originates, is not the story that it became the myth in the 19th century, that the British cut off the thumbs of weavers so that Manchester cottons and things could be imported to an India that had no weavers. That's the version that went out. What he says, because in those days, Manchester cottons did not exist because the Industrial Revolution had not yet happened. What he says is that the British used to impound weavers in what were effectively weaving concentration camps, and that they had to weave massive amounts in a certain week or a certain month under pressure. And that the weavers were so utterly miserable in this enforced regime that they cut their own thumbs off so they couldn't weave, so they could get out of these corrals. Now, that may or may not be a true story, because Bolts is not an accurate source. But that's where that story begins. And we know that it wasn't true, because there were no Manchester cottons until about 40 or 50 years later, and the British hadn't even got to the stage of being able to import cloth to this country. They were there to buy Indian cloth, and so common sense tells you that it's not a true story, as well as the historical. So it's very important, as well as cutting down the myths on one side and educating people about the horrors of empire, to be very careful about the facts and not to allow other pernicious facts on the other side to cloud clear, calm assessment of what actually did happen and what didn't.
Returning to the theme of empire and the sort of elasticity of that term, in The Anarchy, you compare East India Company to the transnational corporations like Amazon. We've actually witnessed in recent years, we are all now fully colonized in a sort of bloodless takeover by Elon Musk. Can you take the concept of empire further away from the treatment that you've done so far into areas like this?
I met somebody in the green room who said, actually, you should start doing virtual empires, because people need to know how digital technology is colonizing not just minds. It starts with the pocket. And actually, that is one thing that it has in common with all the empires that we study. It starts with the profit motive each and every time. And then it goes to the minds, and very rarely does it care about hearts and minds. Hearts get left out. So, it's something we haven't considered, but it's something that we might. But at the moment, we're having tremendous fun just picking where to go next. So the Ottomans, I think, have been another fabulously sort of misrepresented period in history. This idea of a sort of a... And it's because of, the winner writes the history, right? So, most of the films, they're sort of savages with scimitars, and it doesn't get much further than that. And we have, in the process of doing, this present run that we're in, uncovered just such a rich, interesting, and contemporarily important history. You can see why, so many of the fissures in modern politics stem right from those ancient roots.
So we're still about halfway through this series, and in a sense we're still telling the stories of the heights of Ottoman rule. Where we're heading next is absolutely fascinating, because it's in the conquest of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, when among others Indian sepoys brought up the from Suez, Alan Breeze has Rajasthani cavalry. When he takes the Ottoman army on outside Ascalon. There are people from Jaipur, Jodhpur fighting these wars. Other people from outside my house in Delhi, there's a plaque in Meroli saying, in memorial of the 1,200 people of Badapur and Meroli who lost their lives in the First World War. They weren't in the trenches. They were in Kut, in Basra, and Indians fought those battles. Now, what happens when the British Empire and the French bring down the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War is you get the birth, just like in this country, partition laid the dragon's teeth, which has reaped all the hostility between India and Pakistan that still exists 75 years later and which bedevils politics all over this region to this day. In the same way, what happened with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire gives forth all the horrors, in a sense, that still bedevil the Middle East. So you get Palestine and Israel. The fight, Palestine is promised to the Arabs and to the Jews by the British. And so when the First World War breaks out, you have this, at the end of the Second War, you have the Balfour Declaration, which makes this statement that that Palestine should be a Jewish homeland which will in no way endanger the rights of the indigenous people. Now, that's an impossible promise to make. Yeah. And as we know, the Palestinians have been pushed back and back into smaller and smaller enclaves, and it's become an Israeli state with a dominant, now nationalist Israeli government. That's one story. Greece and Turkey, that's a second. The genocide of the Armenians and the leftover of the Armenians. The fact that the Kurds haven't got a homeland and they're being bombed in Syria this week. The fact that there's an issue about the caliphate and what happens to the caliphate, ISIS. That goes back to this. And so one after another of these stories comes from this history, which if you don't know it, you can't understand
what's
happening.
You can't understand, exactly.
And then the Saudis. Mm. Ibn Saud comes out of the end of the First World War, again with sort of not resisted by the British, not helped. And so the birth of Saudi Arabia, and with it, the birth of Wahhabi, not the birth, but the propagation with oil revenues of a particular form of Wahhabi Islam, which had then been marginal and which now is, in a sense, the norm, and which is a far more orthodox, far more hardline type of Israel, the type of Islam than the type which was dominant here, which was very Sufi and extremely different in its...
So this political hinterland is very much closer than people might think. Is that why people are turning to the podcast? Well, how do you explain this?
So it's astonishing, because when we started it off, it was largely because we very much enjoy each other's company, and it was a kind of an excuse to be geeky and nerdy together in a really fun way. And we thought, you know, it'll have a limited run, it will have a limited appeal, especially because, you know, there are people in the past when, you know, I presented them the opportunity to do something on Empire who've said, there's no appetite for this. So we started off with
and they only commissioned 10 episodes to begin with.
Limited expectation, but this thing went mad.
Blown up.
It just, I can't tell you, we started in the second week of August, and, you know, this lovely company that we work with just said we've never seen an exponential rise like this in listeners. And it started off very much that we had a very British audience and people writing into us, you know, much as I said to William, that I didn't know this. Why didn't we know this? This is only as far back as the First World War, and we have parades for that. Why don't we get told this? And suddenly the word started spreading, and suddenly we noticed, about 2 months in, it started becoming more and more international. So we have a very great and growing audience from Australia and New Zealand, America, because these are themes that are universally interesting. You know, it may not... Things like, for example, you know, we just recently done an episode on coffee. And front and center in this coffee episode, and why, you know, we all love coffee. But, you know, the place where coffee, one of the richest places in the world at the time, was in Yemen, a place called Mocha, which was exporting the very first beans, which was, and you look at that, you frame it with the modern day pictures of the place. You need the context, and you need to have that context to be sufficiently responsive and intelligent, especially when it comes to decisions about the world around you. Important people in particular could benefit.
So you've heard what she said. The second this ends, you need to all get on your phones and download it right away. Are we about to hit a massive major milestone by any chance?
We are about to tip over 5 million, which is just ridiculous, you know? Which is, for a history podcast about empire, you know, which is an awkward, thorny, difficultly shaped, you know, difficultly, that works for a podcast, not in writing, but, you know, awkwardly shaped subject. Is extraordinary, and we're thrilled.
Talking of awkward, what do you argue about? And I'm going to be watching Callum's face to see, what do you argue about and who wins?
She does.
I mean,
wise.
I tell you, we don't argue about much, except there are. I mean, you have. He's like, you know, Doctor Who doesn't have to obey the laws of time. This is the new incarnation. Yeah, it just has. It's not on purpose. He just has no idea how it works. So I'm there like some kind of bionic Mary Poppins with my umbrella. Come on, chip chop. Let's get on with it. But that, I mean, that's fun. But we don't tend to argue. We've not fallen out.
Willie, are you ever guilty? For example, of becoming intoxicated by the exuberance of your own verbosity? Ever, perhaps. Does that happen?
I don't know.
Can you imagine?
Could that happen? I don't know. Next awkward question is, and this is something I don't understand. Literature festivals, we rarely talk about money and the lack of it. Basically, yeah. Most writers are skint because there's just no money in it. Are you suddenly wealthy since August?
Yeah, the drinks are on him.
No, seriously, how does it make money?
There is a commercial sense in doing a podcast. If you, that's not the reason to do it, and that's not the reason I think that we did it. We did it for the interest and just to see what would happen. And because we both had a feeling, and we've been toiling in the same field where, you know, certain people say there's no interest, and we know there is. We just feel it that there is. So that's why we went into it, but it hasn't hurt. The money hasn't hurt.
And the our sister podcasts, which are The Rest Is Politics and The Rest Is History, which literally are number one, number two, and number three in the British podcast charts.
So how much money does it make?
Of significant winners.
How rich are you? We want to know. Do we want to know? Just like 5 million downloads. How does that translate?
Go and ask Tom Holland, who's on the next stage.
Might
find he's flowing from
Everybody's downloading it for free as a business model.
So the business model is sponsorship, and the business model is commercials. And that's
where you do your cheeky adverts.
Yeah.
Anita, because she works for the BBC, says, I can't read adverts.
I can't endorse it.
So I have to do the hard work on the adverts.
Yeah, no. So William does you actually do a very beautiful voiceover now.
So the advertising revenue goes to the podcast.
So it's split three ways. Company gets a third. He gets a third. I get a third. So it's very clean in that way. It's sort of it's enormously democratic. And there's also a speed that appeals to me. You know, there's a craftsmanship. We've both worked for organisations that spend a lot of time making things beautiful. There is something down and dirty and punchy about doing this, which actually appeals to another part of my psyche. Obviously, I had no idea I was sort of punchy like this. But there is some purity of having an idea, sitting down, having a chat, can we do this idea? Him reaching into his little black book and saying, I know exactly the right person we should get on, and then just doing it.
It's quite a quick turnaround. You can just make it happen.
Yeah, no, I know. It's pretty much recorded as live.
Edits very quickly.
Yeah, Callum, this is a poor beleaguered man in the white T-shirt. Please go and buy him a drink or give him a hug. Because for him, I think dealing with the two of us is like herding cats. On a daily basis.
I can see the trauma in his eyes, actually.
I know, poor man. I know. We're all saving up for a therapist for him. But, you know, we're very grateful, Callum. Thank you very much.
And you've banked a whole load of recordings whilst you were here. Can you tell us anything about what's coming down the pipeline?
I'm so excited for you to hear this new series. So, that's really... I'm so excited that you brought it up because it's blown me away. So the next one we're doing is not... is strictly the beginning, birth, and end the dominance of a country, but an idea of slavery. So we're starting right from the beginning of ancient slavery, because you know there is a lot of, you know, why do you always talk about the transatlantic slave? What about, you know, the ancient slavers? And we thought, okay, you know what? What about that? Let's talk about it. Let's talk about all of those different types.
So
of
slavery. We've recorded while we've been here, David Wengrow, who was sitting in this seat yesterday. On the origins of inequality, because this whole question of, you know, was early man running around hunting animals and before agriculture, before cities, was there equality then?
Yeah, when I mean, basically, I subtitle that in my head as, are humans just bastards? Which is that just what we're like? So that's a really interesting
thing. So it's very interesting. You have, from the very beginning, signs of inequality and signs of slavery and capture of human beings. You also have societies which had slavery, which ended it. So the idea that there's one emancipation is false. There are also, there's a myth out there which David has taken on, that the big moment of the growth of inequality in societies is when you get agriculture. Agriculture in turn leads to the ability to have settlements. which grow into cities, and with cities come the first rulers and kings and emperors. So you get the pyramids, you get the ziggurat of Ur. But there is great evidence, and David writes about it in his fabulous book, The Dawn of Dawn of Everything, that there are other societies which are very egalitarian, notably the Indus Valley civilization, where there isn't everyone's houses are exactly the same size. Everyone has plumbing. And so it isn't true that all societies are inherently unequal. There are variations. Human beings have these choices that they can make. We can form the societies that we want. It's a very interesting philosophical start.
Yeah, it's a choice. I mean, that thing is that, you know, we aren't inherently bastards is the answer, but do listen to the podcast. There are choices to be made. But also there are you know, things that are, again, you know, I love this challenge that this series has presented. So, you know, there is often this belief, particularly in England, that, you know, Wilberforce and emancipation was like a light that went on. A light goes on and go forth, you are free. And we've talked to Chris Mandrapa.
Which is exactly what happens in the movie Wilberforce, isn't it? Where Benedict Cumberbatch releases people from slavery and there's huge cheer in the House of Commons and everyone bursts into tears and the slaves
but the
are
truth
free.
Is different.
It
the
didn't
truth
happen.
Is nutty and gnarly and long, and the fact that actually, you know, you could be told that you're emancipated, but then you have to do 14 years of unpaid indentured labour afterwards, and you're not allowed to go back to your families. And it is a semantic change of that you are free as a slave or as an indentured labour. I mean, are either of those things true? So all of these things are stored up in this slavery series, bringing us right up to date and actually also to the shores of India, but wait and see.
I'm really excited
One of the things which
season.
I didn't know, which we heard yesterday from Chris, and this is a very important thing for you guys to know, is that the number of slaves moved from Ethiopia and the east coast of Africa to India is the same as the number of slaves moved in the transatlantic slave trade to the Caribbean. And I'm now going to, we're
in
now going to be doing,
because there's which
a huge, there's huge they're called here the Habshis. And if you look at the courts of Awadh or the Deccan, there are these extraordinary, both slave, the existence of slaves, but also in the Deccan, rulers who came from slave backgrounds, the most famous of which is Malikamba, who took on the Mughals, fought Jahangir, and who developed the guerrilla tactics that Shivaji and the Marathas then use against the Mughals two generations
can I,
later.
May I point out one more thing? You know, apart from the timing thing, he doesn't get suspense. So I literally just said, and we come to the shores of India, but you'll have to watch this space. He does it all the time in the
he
podcast.
He just leaked in, didn't he?
A good story is a good story.
I do this beautifully crafted, and you'll find out, apparently in the next nanosecond, because he can't sit on a story. He doesn't understand suspense.
But it's also very much the nature of the podcast that you find one extraordinary thing and then it leads you off in a whole new direction. So
that
it's actually
true.
Very hard to stay on track, as I'm finding out, trying to kind of rein you two in.
You're
They're
feeling
impossible.
A little Callum's pain. Sorry,
so
B.
So podcasts are absolutely huge in the US. They're blowing up in the UK. What's it like here in India? Are people downloading you?
Well, you know, it's funny. It reminds me of that sort of time when digital TV was about to take off. And I sort of get the impression that the podcasts are just at that very sweet point where people are starting to get it and starting to understand that you can carry the world in your pocket. So, I mean, it is all available to you. And we are growing, but you're quite a young market. But I think, you know, just as with that digital time when everything suddenly, you know, once there was just a Doordarshan and then you woke up like Rapunzel the next day, you know, not Rapunzel, Sleeping Beauty, and the next day there's 60
million of these
things.
I remember watching MTV for the first time here. They put on U2, The Fly from... and there was this first time I'd ever seen a music video in India.
Yeah, but it happens quickly. So I think here, you know, the number of you lovely people, and we're so grateful, honestly, who've come up and said, we love Empire and we love this about Empire. But this is still a very new market.
Do not hesitate to get tuning in. I spoke to your alleged rival. I nobbled Tom Holland of, you know, the other podcast in your stable.
Yeah, the place that dare not
and
speak
And I tried
its
to
name.
Get him to be indiscreet. I tried to say, oh, you know, rivalry. And he was just way too gentlemanly and he wouldn't partake in any of that. But he has consistently pointed out an absence in your podcast, and it is the absence of Marilyn Monroe. And if you wish to adjust that now, I may be able to help with that.
Well, you have something?
May I?
Yes.
It's actually very little known. I mean, people know that Marilyn Monroe, the actor, was a great supporter of literature, not just because she was married to Arthur Miller, but she was also a keen advocate of the limerick art form.
Oh.
So if I may, this is one from Marilyn Monroe, which is, I think, very themed to Jaipur Literature Festival.
Sitting on the edge of my seat.
There was an old fellow named Sidney who drank till he ruined a kidney. It shriveled and shrank, and he drank and he drank. But he sure had fun doing it, didn't he? So surely you're in the lead now in the Monroe-ometer, if nothing else.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.